I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Republicans in Congress have tried to overturn the Affordable Care Act some 70 times, and it's been argued now 3 times before the U.S. Supreme Court in the decades since it became law. Yesterday, 18 Republican attorneys general supported by the Trump administration argued that eliminating the fine associated with the individual mandate, which Congress did in 2017, makes the ACA unconstitutional and therefore should be completely dismantled. The other side, representing Democrats from 20 states, D.C., and the House of Representatives, countered that the mandate was constitutional, but even if it weren't, the ACA should remain intact. The court, with its brand new justice, Amy Coney Barrett, is more conservative now, but reports from yesterday's hearing describe a majority of justices skeptical about tossing the health care law. Today on Radio Times, what were the arguments pro and con? What is the status of the ACA and its future? We have two guests who have joined us. Julie Rovner joining us by Skype. She's chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, host of the podcast, What's the Health? Julie Rovner, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us is Allison Hoffman. She's an expert on healthcare law and policy, also a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School, and a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. Allison Hoffman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Glad to be here.
Julie, let me begin with you, and I do want to take apart all the arguments pro and con. How did the mandate, though, become the center of this constitutional argument?
Well, of course, back in 2017, the Republicans came right out of the gate when President Trump was inaugurated, said they were going to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Of course, Republicans in the 7 years that they'd been trying to come up with a replacement had not been able to agree amongst themselves. And in the end, the rather famous thumbs down from John McCain, they were not able to repeal and replace the law. So they moved on to a big tax cut bill that they were planning to do after they did the health care. And as part of that tax cut bill, they thought they would get rid of the most hated piece of the Affordable Care Act, which is the penalty for not having insurance. But because of the budget reconciliation technique they were using, which enabled them to pass tax bill with only 50 votes rather than the usual 60 in the Senate, they could not take out the mandate itself, but they could lower the penalty to zero. And that's what they did. And then a couple of months later, actually in February, just 2 months later, these Republican attorneys general said, you know, in 2012, the Supreme Court said that the law was only constitutional because of the tax, which you have now, you know, lowered to zero. And what they say is that there's now simply a command in the law to buy insurance, although what it really says is you have to prove you have insurance or pay a penalty of nothing. But they maintain that that is a command to buy insurance, and therefore not just that provision, but the whole law is unconstitutional. So that's basically how we got to where we are.
Well, that's a very concise description, and it raises a whole host of questions. Allison Hoffman, let me turn to you. Picking up on this idea about a mandate that has no penalty attached to it and is interpreted, I guess, as a command, picking up on Julie Rovner's language there. So what was the argument coming from the Republicans? What were they trying to argue before the court?
So they were picking back up on the arguments that had been argued in 2012 when the mandate was challenged in the Supreme Court the first time in an FIB versus Sebelius. And in that case, there were three arguments for why the mandate might be constitutional. One was that it was constitutional. So that this whole case has to do with whether Congress could pass the mandate in the first place. Does Congress have the power to legislate such a thing? And there were three arguments that were floating through the courts at that time. One was that it's part of interstate commerce. Healthcare is part of commerce. When people spend on healthcare, that's part of commerce. So it's constitutional under the Commerce Clause, which is a lot of how Congress tends to legislate. A second argument was that it was a necessary and proper piece of acting under another one of Congress's enumerated powers. And the third was this argument that it's a tax. And as the case worked its way up through the courts, because Congress has the ability to tax and spend, and so as it worked its way up through the courts, the first two arguments were the ones that gained the most traction. The third was the one that won the day, because Justice Roberts ended up being the deciding vote in the case. And he said, well, if the mandate is enforced through a tax penalty, then it looks like a tax. Who enforces the thing? It's the IRS. How do you know if somebody has complied with the mandate? It's because they have to attest as part of their Their annual tax returns that they do indeed carry health insurance. So that's how we got back to this point, is that, you know, now the parties who are arguing that the mandate is now unconstitutional again say, well, you already told us it wasn't A and it wasn't B. You decided it was C, it was a tax, and now it doesn't have that tax penalty that made you intuit that it looked like a tax the first time through. So now it looks, you know, freshly unconstitutional again. And then they added on to that. And if this mandate is unconstitutional, then the entire law has to go.
Julie, let me go back to you and even go back to what Congress did in 2017. As you said, they kept the mandate. They took away the tax or the fine or the penalty, but the mandate is still there. Was that part of the argument coming from the Democrats, which is Congress kept the mandate when they could have potentially gotten rid of it?
That was part of the argument, although, I mean, they were making the argument mostly that if Congress had intended to take down the whole law, they would have taken down the whole law. They intended to do exactly what they did, which was lower the penalty to zero and leave everything else intact. Frankly, it's not a matter of whether Congress intended or wanted to do that. That was the only thing they had the votes to do. So that's basically what they did. But a lot of legal scholars say that, you know, it would be very, and even the Chief Justice mentioned this, it would be hard to suggest that Congress intended to take down the whole law when they had the chance and spent some time trying to take down the whole law in 2017 and didn't.
Well, let me go back to you, Allison, and there's this whole question of standing. And, you know, if someone is harmed, that gives them standing before the court. But if you have a mandate that has no penalty, is anyone harmed by keeping it in the law?
So that was it was the first question. And it's interesting, as I hear Julie talk about this case, it reminds me of how I've thought about this case all along, is that there's just layers of arguments, each one that seems a little bit more implausible than the other. And part of what I thought was really interesting yesterday was the case when it was in the district court in Texas, and then it went to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, the case really ended up being argued on the substantive arguments. And the district court judge and the Fifth Circuit bought those substantive arguments by the Republican states. As I watched the case move through at every stage, I thought it was surprising because the legal arguments are pretty hollow. And then yesterday, that both the nature of how the justices asked questions about it and kind of what they focused on implied that it's likely that they agree that there's not a lot of legal merit to this claim. And so the first piece that they spent quite a bit of time on was, do the two individual plaintiffs in the 18 states led by Texas even have the right to bring this case? To bring a case in court, you have to show that you've been harmed. And in this case, because they're challenging the individual mandate, they have to attest that they've been harmed by a mandate that has no penalty. And that is really, it feels like a stretch legally. And the justices were really pushing on that. And they talked about things like Roberts was bringing up lawn mowing ordinances that don't have any enforcement mechanism.
Lawn mowing ordinances.
You said
lawn mowing ordinances?
Lawn mowing ordinances. Okay. If there were a lawn mowing ordinance with no penalty, and, you know, other than that your neighbors might look at you for not complying, would you really be harmed? Would you be harmed under the law? And then, you know, the state said that it increases their reporting costs. But the arguments on the states led by California were that there's no evidence of that, and that most of the reporting costs that the states were talking about were actually triggered by things other than the mandate. So the justices spent a lot of time pushing on whether the individuals of the states were really harmed by a mandate that has been hollowed out, that really has no enforceability.
Julie, would you a couple of articles that I read in preparation for the show talked about a skeptical court when it came to the plaintiff's arguments. Was that is that what you saw and heard?
Oh, very much so. I think, you know, going into this, prior to Justice Ginsburg's death, no one thought that this case had much of a chance because they assumed that the four liberals and the Chief Justice, who has now twice voted in what are deemed by legal experts much stronger cases, the Chief Justice has sided to keep the law. So nobody really thought that he was going to change his position on this. But of course, the addition of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the court would make the three liberals and the Chief Justice a minority. So there was at least some more concern. But what we saw, I think, is what a lot of legal scholars had suggested, suggested, which is that this is not the world's strongest case. In fact, that's why this is in front of the Supreme Court now. The Fifth Circuit actually sent the case back down to the district court judge, who said the whole law had to go. And the Fifth Circuit said, maybe you should take a closer look and maybe the whole law doesn't have to go. But that was going to take an enormous amount of time and have to come back to the Fifth Circuit. And the Democratic states went straight to the Supreme Court and said, look, this is just too much limbo to leave this enormous law in. You really need to step in now. And that's why the Supreme Court did. So until the death of Justice Ginsburg, there was every assumption that this case was likely to just go away.
And how about for Justice Amy Coney Barrett, or Julie Rovner? What did she say? How did she participate in yesterday's proceedings?
Well, one of the really interesting things about the way the court is doing these arguments, which is by phone, you know, normally one of the lawyers will get up to talk and they won't get through a second sentence before one of the justices interrupts them to ask questions. And you don't get every justice participating. In fact, Justice Thomas is rather famous for not asking questions at oral arguments. But doing it on the phone, the Chief Justice calls on everyone one at a time. So everybody does get to ask a question. Justice Barrett, of course, the least senior, goes last. She did not tip her hand, although she did seem to, you know, she also, like many of them, suggested that, you know, it's not entirely clear that either the states or these two individuals, who, by the way, have not been allowed to be interviewed by the media. We only have their affidavits that said that, you know, they felt compelled to buy insurance they didn't want because of this mandate, which has no penalty. So it's not entirely clear whether they have standing. That was a lot of what the justices were asking about.
Well, and we're almost up on a break here, but Alison Hoffman, there was this whole question about severability, which is, can the ACA hold intact if the mandate is ruled unconstitutional? And in 60 seconds or less, can you speak to that?
So severability is kind of the core of the legal claims. If you get to the substance, you have to decide if the mandate is unconstitutional. If the justices say it's unconstitutional, then they have to decide if the rest of the law should go. And the justices were pretty clear yesterday that they didn't think that the whole law should turn based on the mandate. Kavanaugh pretty much said it's all but a done deal. This is, you know, this precedent tells us that the mandate should be severable from the rest of the law. Roberts said we spent all this time talking about broccoli for nothing. And, you know, he was recognizing that the law is different, really, than it was in 2017 than it was in 2010. And the way the world stood in 2017, it seems like Congress left the law in place, zeroed out the mandate. And that's pretty clear. You know, it's pretty clear that not only that was what they intended to do, but as Julie said earlier, that's all they could do. And so, you know, looking to the court to do more than that seems like overstepping. So the justices were pretty clear on this question of severability, which if they get to the substance will be kind of the core of what the opinion's about.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about some of the arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday involving the Affordable Care Act. That's Alison Hoffman. She's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School, senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowitz. I'm talking with Julie Rovner and Alison Hoffman about what happened before the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday, arguments regarding the Affordable Care Act, and we're deconstructing some of the arguments coming from the Republicans and from the Democrats. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Julie, let me read something that Justice Brett Kavanaugh said yesterday during the oral arguments, and I'm quoting here. It does seem fairly clear that the proper remedy would be to sever the mandate provision and leave the rest of the act in place. This is this whole question about severability, but I guess we know where he stands on this particular argument.
Well, we thought we knew. There were a lot of people who had been saying that before this happened, that it was likely to get Kavanaugh on the severability, because he said this before about other laws, even in his first, you know, full term on the court last year. He has been dubious about taking out enormous parts of a law if one part is found to be unconstitutional. So in that sense, it wasn't a surprise. It was a little bit of a surprise that he said it so, you know, plainly. You know, again, you can never tell what they're going to do based on the oral arguments, but that did seem to be sort of a surprising tipping of the hand. One of the things that really, I think, and I was glad it came up in the arguments because it had not really come up in the earlier court cases, which is that the mandate penalty has been gone now for almost 2 years. Right. And the law is actually doing just fine without it. And that Justice Alito, of all people, who is not a fan of the Affordable Care Act, pointed that out. He used the analogy of, you know, of a plane flying with what was thought to be an essential piece of it. And now they've taken it out and the plane has not crashed. And I thought that actually was more surprising to me than what Justice Kavanaugh said.
Well, that's fascinating. Also, let me read a comment from Dean, who says, I feel that requiring someone to purchase a product or service is a form of legalized extortion with a bit of usury tossed in. Can your guest comment on this? And this obviously has to do with the mandate, which actually has no tax or penalty associated with it. But I'm also thinking about sort of insurance in general. If you have a car, you need to buy insurance. Is that legalized extortion and usury?
So this goes back to why the mandate has ended up in court so many times, and you know why it has been so contentious, is that it rubs people the wrong way. It's the federal government saying that you have to purchase something. And the first case, when it made its way to the Supreme Court the first time, that's what most of the argument was about, is can Congress tell you that you have to carry health insurance? And the court said, yes, in that case, it can. It does have the power to do that. But that doesn't mean that the people will, you know, then feel like that's a valid exercise of governmental power. A lot of people still feel like it's overreaching. So what is different about the mandate and car insurance, if I were to think about, you know, the lived experience, is that the states say that to people, you know, you have to have car insurance if you want to drive a car. And what the Affordable Care Act says is you have to carry health insurance, period. And that's why the case ended up in the Supreme Court. And there were all these arguments that really pushed at, you know, where are the bounds of what Congress can do or not do? And here we saw the law kind of, you know, aligning with a lot of people's instincts, is that a mandate in and of itself could be, in some cases, you know, kind of beyond the bounds of what we've allowed Congress to do in the past when Justice Roberts wrote the first opinion. But in the end of the day, he said, no, if it's enforced by a tax penalty, it looks like a tax and Congress can do that. That doesn't mean that, you know, kind of the larger perception of it's still not going to be negative, because people don't like a mandate. We see that right now with COVID. Sure. And the states that are enacting mask mandates is people don't want to be told what to do with their dollars and with their bodies.
Julie, if my memory serves me, that the mandate was really a conservative idea that came from the Heritage Foundation several decades ago. Do I have that right or wrong?
You have that sort of right. Actually, the original mandate came from a professor there at the University of Pennsylvania, Mark Pauley.
A number
of colleagues, and it was later picked up by the Heritage Foundation. But yes, it was originally the conservative alternative to an employer mandate, which is what the Democrats had been pushing for many years. They were going to require all employers to provide health insurance. This was in the days where we didn't have so many people in the gig economy working for themselves. So the Democrats wanted to do an employer mandate. The conservatives wanted to do an individual mandate. They also started to have to trip over this idea of people don't like the idea of being told what to do, although I should point out that legally, and I think this is how the Chief Justice sort of justified it when he upheld it in 2012, it's not so much a mandate as a choice. You have a choice to either have health insurance or pay this penalty. And that was some of what came up yesterday, because now you have a choice of buying health insurance or paying a penalty of zero.
Which, I mean, I half understand some of these legal arguments, but that just seems almost nonsensical, Julie Ravner.
It does, and that's why we've seen a number of conservative legal scholars who supported the other two challenges to the Affordable Care Act saying this is a ridiculous lawsuit. I mean, they've basically said it in pretty much those words. And, you know, as we've discussed, it's entirely possible the Supreme Court won't even get to the merits of this case. They may well find that no one has standing to bring it, and it will be dismissed on that basis. But if they do, there's also every reason, at least from what we can tell, they may find that the mandate without a penalty is unconstitutional, but that no other part of the law has to fall.
Let me read a couple of comments, Allison Hoffman. They're all related. A question from Kate. I've never understood why Republicans want to get rid of something that's so popular. What is the reasoning behind these repeated attempts? An email from George. Also wondering about why Republicans keep trying to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. A comment from James from Malvern. The Republicans have to stop wasting precious time on these politically motivated cases when there are far more serious issues. And I think that the question being raised is that if you want to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, what are you going to replace it with? And it's pretty clear at this point that the Republicans and President Trump himself don't really have anything to replace the ACA.
That's right. You know,
that's
true.
I'm going to toss that to Allison, but Julia, I'd love to have you weigh in as well. Allison, go ahead.
Oh, I think that's true. And I think that the Republicans put a stake in the ground and they said this is going to be an issue that politically, as we campaign, we're going to resist this Obamacare and we're going to try to repeal it. And when Trump was elected and we had a Republican majority in Congress in 2016, they turned to try to do that. And they didn't even have the votes then to do it. John McCain ended up being the vote that, that tipped the hand away from repealing the Affordable Care Act. But all along, people have been saying if they were to repeal it, what would they replace it with? And there hasn't been a great answer, in part because the Affordable Care Act was really a compromise idea that, as Julie was talking about, was seeded by Mark Pauley and then picked up by the Heritage Foundation and other, you know, more conservative-leaning think tanks. And so there wasn't an obvious idea in its wake that the Republicans could put together that would be a comprehensive reform. Now, if you step back now and talk to a number of the Republican senators and ask them, do you really want to see this law go? I think if you got an honest answer, many would say, not really. We don't have, especially during a pandemic, we don't have a great alternative to get people health insurance quickly. But it's just become a political rallying cry that I think it's been hard for people to let go of.
Julie, how do you see that?
Yeah, you know, people make, there's so much sort of ink spilled and talk about how the Democrats don't agree about health care. You have sort of the Medicare for All faction and the Let's Improve the Affordable Care Act faction. But the fact is the Republicans are every bit as divided on this as the Democrats. And it's not that they lack ideas, it's that they lack consensus. The Republicans have never been able to agree on what a replacement would look like. And in fact, that famous vote from John McCain, that thumbs down, was not even the vote was not at that point on a replacement. It was basically a proposal to kick the can down the road for a couple of months and see if they could come up with something else. That was actually what that last vote was after they had failed to get enough votes for some sort of small bore replacement. So Republicans really have had no plan for these past 10 years because there's nothing that they can rally around. But what they can rally around is that they don't like the Affordable Care Act. So I think that goes back to the original question, why are they still fighting about this? Because it's the only thing in healthcare that they agree on.
That's Julie Rovner. She's chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She's also the host of the What the Health podcast. Allison Hoffman with us as well. She's an expert on healthcare law and policy. She's also a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School and a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. We are talking about some arguments yesterday before the U.S. Supreme Court involving the Affordable Care Act. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and do it the old-fashioned way. Pick up the phone and call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Allison Hoffman, I thought it was interesting that the insurance industry, hospitals, the American Medical Association, I'm sure there are others as well, all are in support of the Affordable Care Act. After 10 years, is it here to stay?
I think after yesterday, we can pretty confidently say it's here to stay unless we have a Congress at some point in the future that has the political votes and the idea to replace it with something else. But now we have a system where 20 million more people have health insurance. than would have otherwise. And so, you know, all of the organizations that benefit when people have health insurance, and that health insurance can pay for care, the hospitals, the doctors, the pharmaceutical companies, don't want to see those sources of payment go away unless there's something really compelling to take its place. I can't imagine that we won't continue talking about health policy. It's, you know, it's kind of a perpetual topic that cycles in and out. But I think in the near future, the ACA is here to stay. We may see Biden trying to supplement it in kind of small ways, but I don't imagine anything dramatic happening in the near future.
How about you, Julie? Do you see any dramatic changes on the horizon?
No, but I never say never. I mean, I did not. I went to the press conference where this lawsuit was unveiled on the theory of, oh my goodness, what is it that they're doing here? Thinking that, you know, it wouldn't really be anything. Although, as I said in a note to my editor, you never know what this might morph into. And here we are.
Well, I thought it was interesting. I think it was Chief Justice Roberts was talking about kind of people rummaging around through the Affordable Care Act, Julie Rovner, and sort of looking for another reason to challenge it. I mean, it's been 10 years, and I'm sure there's something there that someone could rummage around and find. But sort of how many bites of the apple do you get when it comes to something like the Affordable Care Act?
Well, there are a number of individual provisions that people are still fighting over, most notably the requirement for birth control, for employers to provide that. That's still sort of a live issue that's kicking around. So there are other pieces of it, but those aren't considered, you know, threatening to the entire structure of the act. It's really been around the mandate that we've seen, you know, these kinds of challenges. So I fully expect that there'll be more lawsuits against various parts. And of course, you know, every time an administration does a regulation that impacts part of it, whoever feels like they will be the loser of that change will sue. So I think we will see many more lawsuits involving the Affordable Care Act. I don't know whether we'll see very many more that threaten its existence.
Hmm. And I wonder to you, Alsenhoffen, were there justices who were sympathetic to the argument coming from the Republicans from Texas?
There were definitely justices that seemed sympathetic to parts of the argument. So the piece that we saw the conservative-leaning justices more sympathetic to was the argument that the individual mandate is now unconstitutional. And so Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, others asked, you know, how could it still be a tax if there's zero penalty attached to it? Whereas others, Kagan and Breyer, pushed back in the other direction. Kagan asked questions about if something has less teeth than it did before, how could it now be unconstitutional if it was constitutional before? Breyer was saying there's lots of statements in the law that are, you know, statements about what people should do. Are every one of those unconstitutional if they're just kind of commands within the law without any enforcement attached? But I think on that piece, that's the piece where I saw the most traction for the arguments, you know, against the Affordable Care Act, is that, you know, the justices might be amenable to the notion that now that there's no penalty attached, it no longer looks like a tax and it's unconstitutional. Again, the piece that then follows is, if it's unconstitutional, must the rest of the law go? And I think we saw a pretty strong consensus among justices yesterday that they weren't amenable to that argument in the same way that they might be to the constitutionality piece.
So, Julie, does it matter then if the mandate is in the law? I mean, obviously, if it took down the whole law, that would matter. But if the justices decide that it's either constitutional or unconstitutional, but the ACA should stay, does that matter? Does the mandate matter anymore?
It does and it doesn't. You know, if they just say that the individual mandate itself, sort of the piece of the phrase that says, you know, you need to prove you have health insurance or else pay a fine. If just that were to go away, well, it's already not very operative because the fine is zero. So that wouldn't have any impact. But one of the other arguments, and this was the original argument from the Trump administration, is that if the mandate is unconstitutional, then the things that are most directly affected by the mandate, so maybe not the whole law, but the things that are most directly affected by the mandate include the pre-existing condition protections, because that was the deal that Congress made with the insurance companies. The insurance company said, we can't afford to cover people with pre-existing conditions, because otherwise all we will get are sick people and premiums will skyrocket and more healthy people will drop out. So we need some way to get healthy people to sign up. That was the origin of the mandate, to encourage the healthy people to sign up if they were required to take the sick people. Well, it turns out, as Donald Riley, who is the former Solicitor General and arguing for the House of Representatives yesterday, said the carrots work better than the sticks, the carrots being the subsidies to help people afford that insurance. So it turns out that even without the penalty, people were buying insurance because they were healthy people, because they were getting a lot of financial help to do it. And that so the question is for the justices, do you need to take out the pre-existing condition protections? Or, as Justice Alito said, the plane is actually flying without them. So maybe we should leave well enough alone. And that's kind of what I'm watching for. If the justices get to the merits, whether they will just strike the mandate or strike the mandate and the things that immediately surround it.
Well, Allison, I mean, it seems to me that if the mandate is unpopular, the pre-existing part of the ACA is extremely popular. Can you speak to that?
The pre-existing conditions coverage requirement has been one of the most popular parts of the law. It's been a piece that both Democrats and Republicans have stood behind. So even if the court were to strike that piece down, I could imagine legislation putting it back in place. It was one of the pieces that I was looking for in the arguments yesterday, was how much time were the justices going to spend talking about what pieces of the law are so intertwined with the mandate that if the mandate goes, they have to go. And we saw very little discussion of that. Now, you could have a surprise opinion that comes out and says, the mandate is so intimately intertwined with things like the requirement that insurers have to offer coverage to everybody who applies, the pre-existing coverage conditions, protections, maybe some of the other rules about how insurers can price policies. It could be that they look at that kind of web of intertwined pieces and say, the mandate is not severable from these pieces and these pieces have to go. But I'm skeptical that that's what we'll end up seeing, just because we saw so little conversation about it. We saw Roberts talking about how in 2017, CBO reports in Congress thought it was quite fine to strike the mandate and to leave the rest of it in place. And if you think about the legal touchstone for severability, the court is supposed to ask, What did Congress intend to do in 2017 when they zeroed out the penalty on the mandate?
Allison, I hate to do this only because we're up on a break. We'll pick up after this very short break talking about the health and future of the ACA. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone. Just to recap, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments yesterday, a Republican challenge to the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate. And we're talking with our guests about some of the arguments pro and con, the future of the ACA. Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and Allison Hoffman, Professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Allison, I had to interrupt to you right before the break. Just finish your thought, and we got some more folks that want to join our conversation.
Sure thing. So when you look at this question of which pieces of the law might have to go with the mandate, the justices are looking to see the touchstone is what did Congress intend in 2017? And the most logical answer is, well, they zeroed out the penalty and they left the rest of the law in place, and that's what they intended, and really that's all that they could do in 2017. And so the court, out of out of kind of its deference to what that Congress intended, should leave those pieces in place. So I would be surprised if we saw some of those provisions, like the pre-existing conditions, go down, even if the mandate were unconstitutional. Now you never know for sure, but that's my feeling coming out of yesterday's arguments.
Especially in a pandemic, do you think that in any way would affect the justices' opinions?
I don't think that is what they would explicitly say in their opinion, but it has to be on their minds. It's on everybody's minds what it would mean to eliminate provisions that are providing people coverage during a pandemic. And especially as you look at the number of Americans who've had COVID, which could be treated as a pre-existing condition. We see some people with lasting impacts of it. I'm sure it's in the backs of people's minds, even if it doesn't come out in the legal opinions.
Yeah, let me get some folks back in on the conversation. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Dan, who is calling us from Winmore. And Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. As Julie Robner just said, it seems that there's a strong argument to be made for severability based on the fact that they did not get rid of the whole law when they had the opportunity. It also seems the Republicans have boxed themselves in somewhat by reducing the penalty of the mandate to zero, in that that sort of robbed anyone of the potential for standing. Number one, which way do you think they're going to go? Number two, the Supreme Court often decides on narrow grounds, which the standing issue would probably give them narrower a narrower out than the full act. So if they reject this case just based on standing, what other grounds could the Republicans bring to overturn the law?
That's a big question, Dan. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Julie, what are your thoughts?
I have no idea. I didn't think they were going to have this one. So, you know, undoubtedly, as I said earlier, undoubtedly they will think of something, because the only thing they agree on in healthcare is that they don't like the Affordable Care Act.
Right. But, you know, this court is now described as conservative, and the Affordable Care Act is this sprawling healthcare law. Is there any, which has some conservative roots to it? Does it even make sense to think of liberals and conservatives and how they think, Julie, about the ACA?
Well, I think people who actually whose career is to bring lawsuits like this do think about it. I mean, I think one of the things that surprised me watching the Supreme Court for as long as I have is how in there were two bites at the apple on what they called the partial birth abortion ban. The Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, struck down a state law, and then the federal government passed a law, and they went back to the court. And I was like, but you just lost this case. Well, in between the striking down the state law and the federal law, the court changed. And suddenly there was a new 5-4. And indeed, that federal law was upheld, even though the state law had been struck down just a couple of years earlier. So, yes, changes in the makeup of the court do change how the court views things.
Well, let me get another caller on, and Allison, I'll give you a chance to respond to Steve. Steve calling us into Radio Times. And Steve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you? Thank you so much
Good.
For taking my call.
You're very welcome.
So I was a Affordable Care Act user for about 3 years. It saved me thousands of dollars. I fell off my bike and split my knee open. I needed minor surgery, et cetera. And without it, I probably would not have been able to work in quickly as fashion as I was able to get back to work. And so, you know, over time, I did see the cost of my health care go up over time. My premiums went up over time. But I also know that enrollment for the Affordable Care Act kind of fluctuated. So, and I also know that the advertising for to enroll was changed, and enrollment windows also changed. So I wanted to know, you know, what other things has the current GOP Trump administration done to kind of hobble enrollment and change those numbers to either, you know, discourage people from enrolling or confuse them about enrollment or prevent them from enrolling entirely? And like, what kind of effect did that have on the public perception of the ACA overall?
Steve, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'll give you a chance to respond. I'm sure, Julie, you've got some thoughts as well. Allison Huffman, what do you say to Steve?
Yeah, Steve, this is a great question. And my first reaction to what you're talking about is that experience of having insurance when you need it that you might not have had otherwise is what makes a law like this sticky over time. And so the more people talk about that, the more you see that in your community, the more I think people you know, are likely to have favorable views of something like the Affordable Care Act, even if they were on the line, you know, kind of on between liking and not liking in the short term. But you also raise another issue that is a challenging one, which is affordability. And it's an issue that Biden has talked about a lot, is how do we make the coverage more affordable? And you know, that I think especially if he had had a stronger majority in Congress, we would have definitely seen movement on. But you're also right that in the you know, in even in the absence of kind of broad sweeping legislation to make coverage more affordable, there's a lot that he could do to encourage enrollment. So we saw the Trump administration doing things like defunding navigators to help people buy plans. Most recently, we saw them approve an application by Georgia to eliminate the use of healthcare.gov, the kind of federal exchange, the website that people go on to buy the coverage, so that people have to go to insurers to buy the coverage directly. These kinds of small steps that could be done through regulatory approval can really hobble enrollment. And I think right away we'll see the Biden administration turn to fixing some of those regulatory pieces that have undermined affordability in the exchanges and enrollment in the exchanges as well.
Julie, actually, let me read an email from Scott. He says, my biggest upset with the ACA is that it does not seem to live up to its name, the name being affordable. Every year I pay more for less coverage and higher deductibles. What has the law done for the middle class? We don't reach any threshold for assistance, and therefore health care has only become more unaffordable. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, this has been, one of the big problems with the Affordable Care Act, is, and the people who wrote it know this. Partly at the beginning, they didn't do some of these things that they could have done because they were afraid that the price tag of the whole bill was getting out of hand. Things like the family glitch, where if you have employer-provided insurance that's too expensive, you can get a subsidy, but that's only for individual insurance, not for family insurance. So if you can't afford your family insurance from your employer, you still can't get a subsidy on the exchange. That was something they knew when it passed that they would like to fix. This is something that candidate Joe Biden talked about a lot, expanding subsidies a little bit further up the income scale, pegging subsidies to the more generous gold plans than the silver plans that they're currently pegged to, which would help people with their out-of-pocket costs, with their deductibles and their coinsurance. But yes, there is a recognition that the ACA does not work as well as they had hoped. And, in a normal law of this size, Congress would have come back several times by now and done, what are called technical corrections that frequently are a little bit less than technical. But because, remember, the House changed hands, the Republicans took the House back over in 2010, just months after the law was passed, and the Democrats have not had full control of the Congress since then, and the Republicans have shown no inclination to try and help the law along. So we now have 10 years of no technical corrections. So things that backers of the law would like to change, they haven't been able to do.
Allison, is there any way to know whether the Affordable Care Act may, obviously it hasn't dealt entirely with the cost structure of our healthcare system, but has it made us healthier? Has it made the system more responsive to the needs of the patients, the customers, the users?
So that's the toughest question, and that's the perpetual question that scholars look at, is when people have health insurance, how does it impact their health at the end of the day? Some of the early evidence that we see on the Affordable Care Act and on other forms of insurance as well is that you see things like higher levels of compliance with drugs. You see people, going to the emergency room and getting care when they need it, and kind of basic access to preventive care. Now, whether that, in the long run, how much that helps people's health and whether it's worth it is a tough question. It's one that lots of scholars have spent a lot of time researching. But we do know that people are at least incrementally getting more of care that tends to make people healthier and complying with what their doctors tell them they need to do to stay healthy.
And Julie, we're talking about, 20 million people who are covered under the ACA that perhaps wouldn't have been covered before?
More like 23 million at this point.
23 million.
Of people who, yes, and of course, since the pandemic and so many people who've lost their employer-provided insurance because they've lost their jobs, so we will know, I think in a few months, that number is almost certainly higher than that right now. But between the people who've been added to the Medicaid rolls and the people who've been able to buy their own insurance on the marketplaces, yeah, it's a good, there's still a lot of uninsured Americans. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 million, probably again higher because of the pandemic. The Affordable Care Act took a large dent out of the number of people who didn't have insurance.
Do you think, Julie, there's any appetite for, Medicare for all, or, there are various things that you can call it, but just a system that is more of a one size fits all, for lack of a better word?
you know, there's this continuing division between Republicans and Democrats on, do you want more government or less government involved in healthcare? And we have a pretty hybrid system right now. We're pretty close to half and half, half government and half private. And each side wants to sort of pull the health system in their direction. I think the idea of going to a purely government system, which is most of Medicare for All, would still have private providers, but it would be a government finance system, or a purely market system, you know, pull back. You know, the Republicans would like to privatize many pieces of the health system that are now public, including Medicare and Medicaid. I think probably neither of those things is likely to happen anytime soon. I think we're likely to continue to sort of fight it out in the middle.
How about for you, Allison? How do you see that?
I'll tell you one thing I'm watching with great interest now is the effects of the pandemic on the health insurance system. So right now, the majority of people who have private coverage have it through their employer. And when they lose their jobs, they lose their health care. Now, fortunately, the Affordable Care Act put a safety net in place so that many of those people could enroll in Medicaid or buy an ACA plan. But I think it shines a light anew on the question of whether employer-sponsored health insurance, getting your health care through your employer, really makes sense. Especially as you see a growth in the gig economy, you see people moving between jobs, you see a pandemic where health insecurity and financial insecurity go hand in hand. So I don't think we're going to see major reform in either direction in the near term, but I do think that these ideas are going to continue percolating.
Julie, do employers want to be the provider of health insurance for their employees?
Yes and no. I think
complicated, right?
It is complicated. Well, you know, one of the big predictions when the Affordable Care Act passed is that particularly small employers who didn't have a requirement to provide insurance would basically dump their workers onto the exchanges. But remember, the exchanges didn't work very well at the beginning. And I think small employers who were offering insurance, they want their employees to be healthy and happy, and they had a feeling that they wouldn't be if they sent them off to the exchanges. So they hung on. Right now, I think most people don't like dramatic change. That's one of the few things we really sort of do understand about how people feel about healthcare. But like Allison, I am also watching to see if the pandemic changes, you know, our view as a society of healthcare and who should have it and who should provide it. I haven't seen that change yet. I'm surprised at how politicized the whole pandemic has become. But, you know,
indeed,
that it might take a while for that to kind of seep in.
Allison, here's a question. How would any alterations to the ACA affect state-based marketplace plans like Pennsylvania's recently launched Penny Marketplace? Can you speak to that since you're in Pennsylvania?
So there may be, there may be federal changes that make it, I would imagine, would ratchet in the direction of making it more attractive for states to have their own exchanges. Pennsylvania has just set up this exchange. And I don't imagine that anything would dramatically affect how that exchange is working and how open enrollment would look in the near term. But we could see some pieces for next year's open enrollment when the new incoming administration has, you know, kind of adjusted the rules that make it easier for people to navigate that space. More federal support for the states that have run their own marketplaces like Pennsylvania.
Julie, we're almost out of time. When do we expect the court to decide on this case?
Probably not until 2021. If it's an easier case, maybe earlier in the spring. If not, when the Supreme Court finishes its term, the end of June.
Well, I learned a lot. Thank you, ladies, for joining us today in Radio Times. Julie Rovner, thank you for joining us once again.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank
Chief
you.
Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and again, host of the What the Health podcast. Allison Hoffman, thank you for joining us on Radio Times once again.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. An expert on healthcare law and policy, also a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School, and a senior fellow at the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. And there are many ways to download a podcast of the show. You can do it wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.